who is also a world-renowned scholar and archaeologist. He is Professor Yohanan Ahroni from Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and currently this semester visiting professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He has been kind enough to consent to come for two lectures today and on Thursday. I have known Dr. Ahroni for several years and have had the pleasure not only to study with him at Hebrew University, where I took seminars, graduate seminars with him, but also had the privilege to work for him on excavations in the Middle East, in particular on the now famous excavation Ramat Rachel, about halfway between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. Professor Ahroni is a scholar of international reputation, author of many books, some of which are in our library, especially those in English, and the two beautiful volumes having to do with the excavations at Ramat Rachel, and then one of his more recent works, A Historical Geography of the Holy Land in Hebrew, has recently been translated by a young Southern Baptist living in Israel today, and will soon be being published by Westminster, and the title will be have to do with the historical geography in the Holy Land, a historical geography, and I predict will be a widely used textbook in the field. It's the finest thing written in my judgment. Those of you who have heard me speak of Dr. Ahroni have heard me say of him that in my opinion he is the most outstanding field archaeologist in the field of biblical archaeology at work today. He'll be a little embarrassed at that high recommendation, but that's my honest judgment of his gifts and talents and abilities in the field of biblical archaeology. We welcome him to this seminary chapel and are glad to give him this opportunity to instruct us in something having to do with our beginnings and the beginnings of our faith, and of course something very important to the history of his own great Hebrew people. Dr. Ahroni, we welcome you with that most wonderful of Hebrew blessings, Baruchim Haba'im.
Well, it's a great pleasure and honor for me to give this lecture here, and especially to be able to give this lecture here in the seminary of Elmu, whom I really enjoyed so very much of working almost about a year long, a few years ago in Israel, and I hope he'll join us in the near future sometimes again. Our lecture on Arat, I hope, will perhaps be a quite nice and impressive example what biblical archaeology means today. And as it, I think, becomes more and more clear, it isn't anymore the rather simple or naive question of the Bible is true or is history or is not. I think these questions doesn't bother us very much these days, evaluating the historical and the traditions in the Bible in quite another light, to quite a great extent, of course, of archaeology, but I would say it really gives us the background, the deeper and truer understanding of many facts and many historical or things of tradition and religion, which I would say without archaeology or without these facts, we couldn't not only understand, but couldn't even grasp or see the problems which are in them. So I would say archaeology isn't a simple matter today which brings simple solutions. I think most excavations, and this excavation at Ararat perhaps especially, by bringing solution to one question, I think usually it opens another 3 or 4 or 10 new questions which we even didn't realize that they existed at all. But I would say today, without taking into consideration this basic fact of archaeology, we would live perhaps easy and happy and simple life, but would be quite far from the true understanding of life and of history in biblical times as we can achieve it now. Our excavation at Ararat, perhaps a short introduction for some of you which are not acquainted with the geography and with the land of Israel and Palestine, is in the southern area, in the Negev, about 30 miles east of Beersheba. It is on the frontier of the desert, and its main importance in antiquity was twofold. First, as a frontier fortress, guarding the settled area, guarding Israel and Judah from the desert, from the Negev, and then standing on one of the most important high routes of ancient Israel, the route climbing down to the Dead Sea, to the Araba, Edom, and the Gulf of Elat, which, without any question, was one of the most important highways in antiquity, as it is today. At Ararat, we found really mainly two periods. The earlier one, belonging to the first centuries of the third millennium BC. That means the early Bronze period, the early stages of the early Bronze period in Palestine. And this is a very, I would say, interesting and surprising city, large city in this area, about 1.5 times the size of Megiddo, surrounded by a stone wall and almost everywhere built up, which is surprising and interesting, not only for the reason that it is one of the earliest cities in Palestine, but for the very reason that it is built here so far in the south, in this today's Semit desert area. And then, of course, that it is so very easy excavated, as most of it has never been settled and has never been built over in later periods. I won't describe today this city. My colleague Ruth Amiran is now mainly working on it, and it is far remote and early, has of course something also to do with biblical archaeology, but quite early and nothing to do with the main problems we'll discuss today and on Thursday. Then this city of Ararat was deserted for at least 1500 years. That means from about 2700 BC to the early phases of the Israelite period of the Iron Age, something about the 11th or beginning of 10th century, the place was completely deserted. And only then a new settlement was established on one corner, at the beginning a small settlement, which was then in the 10th century, probably by Solomon, strongly fortified and made into a royal fortress. Now, we archaeologists, I would say, are usually quite sadistic, if you want, people. As more as a city is burned down and destroyed, we are the happier and don't think about these ancient people in antiquity. Because it's quite clear that as more severely the destruction was, as more suddenly, and if the city has really nicely been burned down, so more the finds and the vessels and many pieces you find on the floors of the ancient fortress or city. Now in Ararat we had the real luck that this fortress was burned not less than 6 times during the first temple period, during the period of the monarchy. From the period of Solomon about in the 10th century to the destruction of the first temple, probably in the first campaign of Nebuchadnezzar in 598 BC, the citadel of Ararat was destroyed 6 times and rebuilt. And all these destructions were sudden and severe destruction with thick, burned layers, and it was really clear that the people left everything behind, fleeing away. And if, for instance, Elmo will compare this with Ramat Rachel, which was relatively, from this aspect, poor, and not very heavily destroyed in anything, in any case, not many times. And we were happy, finally to reach one or two or three rooms with many vessels. So here in Arad, there was really no day which we reached not thick layers of course, destruction and of vessels and all kinds of material left behind in the rooms. And this, of course, the reason was naturally, as we are in the border fortress, which was always the first to be destroyed and fall in any period of emergency. Now, this, of course, six strata, six levels of the Iron Age, from the 10th century to the early 6th century, that means a period of a little more than 350 years, give us the most exact data which we could hope for the dating of the various material found in them. I think it will be one of the bases for the dating of many other excavations in Judea and in southern Palestine. And perhaps the most luck we could hope for, that in most of these strata, in most of these fortresses, we did not only find the buildings, the houses, the plants, the pottery, other vessels, but in almost everyone we found ancient inscriptions, mainly inscribed on potsherds with ink, the so-called ostraca. In our four seasons which we had, we found about 200 early inscribed sherds, early ostraca, which about, I would say, at least double the inscribed material of the ancient periods which we had so far from all our other excavations carried out in Palestine. And I would say the importance of them is not only for their number, but for two other reasons. First, that we are here in a royal citadel, and most of this material belongs clearly, are traces of royal Judean archives in this citadel. And the second reason, that they do not belong to one stratum, like for instance the famous Lachish ostraca or Samaria ostraca, but as I mentioned, we have found ostraca almost in every one of our strata. Out of these six Iron Age strata, we find ostraca in five of them. And what I want to do this lecture is to give you a very short and brief glimpse how this city and citadel and even early city of Arad looks like, and then mainly to give you some short introduction into these inscriptions, into these ostraca, and what really did they bring of new material for this period and for the understanding of the language and the history of this time. So please, let's start with the There's one more light. Yeah, so here you have a general picture of the early Bronze City with the starting of our excavation in this area, which comprises all this, as you see, quite plain and level area here around, from this place up to this higher citadel mound behind, which of course is the high, because there the later settlements and fortresses were built. This gives you a good idea what this excavation in the early Bronze City in Arad means. in any other places so far where these levels of the third millennium BC have been reached, as for instance in Megiddo or Jericho or other places, you always have to dig down through meters and meters of ancient debris, and then not only after much labor and work and years you reach these early finds, but then you are in such a small section that you never can have any real plan, architecture of the early buildings. Now here at Arad, as you see it in this line, the city wall could be traced by, of course, only one and two or three stones appearing here and there, even before the excavation. And what you see here in this photograph is not yet the excavation, but we put only one small group of four workers brushing the area, nothing more, brushing the dust away, and you see already here clearly the appearance of the early city wall, which one of these half circular towers, similar to these discovered in Jericho and in biblical Ai. Here you have the citadel, here the plan of the ancient city wall of this early bronze city, which we detected for a distance of more than a mile, and the city itself we excavated mainly here, with only at this point, of course, laying bare three of these half-circular towers. In an aerial view, you see the city wall, one of these towers broken, and you get at least a glimpse here how building and house beside house covers all these areas, at least which we uncovered, of the large early city. The most astonishing thing that we found here a quite developed and systematic architecture of a so-called broad house, the entrance in one of the longer sides, steps leading down, benches usually around the walls, some kind of a table, and even the door sill here usually found beside the entrance. In archaeology, you usually find only the foundations of houses, the upper parts, of course, have fallen and crumbled in. But here we had luck, and in one of these houses, we found this clay model. We don't know its use, but I think it is quite clear that it gives the general impression how these buildings, this ancient type of building, looked like. And only two pictures of finds of many pottery in this early city. As I mentioned, today almost a desert-like area, but here with rich content, these beautiful and large early bronze vessels, hand burnished with these typical ledge handles, wavy handles of the early bronze period. And the most interesting find, this type of vessel with this peculiar decoration, which have been known up till now mainly from Egypt, from tombs of the first dynasty, called usually the Abydos ware. It was quite clear that they were imported somewhere from Palestine and Syria, and we had now a real surprise to find that our city at Arad was without any question one of the centers of the manufacture and probably export to Egypt of this material in this ancient period. But we'll leave the ancient city, only mentioning still one riddle we have not yet solved, how the water was provided for such a large city in this ancient period, because it is completely clear that Arad has neither a spring nor a well. So the water proviant, water provision could come only from the catching of rainwater. This is comparatively easily done, as you see it here. So it is done even today by the Bedouin, by the nomads. And here you even see the small Bedouin boys enjoying themselves in the first Khamsin days of the spring, bathing in these artificial small basins. I don't think that they get clean out of this, but in any case, they enjoy it. But the real riddle is, these artificial lakes disappear very quickly in the spring. They dry up in 2 or 3 weeks when the heat of the spring starts. And it's quite clear that to store water all the year round, you had to have real cisterns, plastered cisterns or cut in the rock. It is very surprising, and we have not yet really solved this riddle, how in this ancient period they were able to do this. But now let's go over to the Citadel Mount. What I'm showing you here is not the last burning level. We had no opportunity to take a photograph of this, but this is the morning dew of Ararat. Almost every morning, people usually think Ararat in the south, in the Negev, must be a very hot and unpleasant city from the point of climate. That's not true at all. We are here about 1800 feet high. It's a very, I would say, even fresh and sometimes cool climate. And almost every morning, coming to the tail, we got almost wet by these clouds of dew and mist which we found there. The citadel itself is comparatively small. It has only a size of about 50 to 50 meters. That means a fortress, very strongly fortified, but no city in this period, which was only somehow probably around this fortress. Now the main contents of the fortress didn't change much during this sixth period, but the fortification changed. The last one, the blue wall here, was a casemate wall. That means a double wall. And it is perhaps important to remember this. I'll show it once again in connection with our sanctuary. Before it, you have this red wall, a solid wall, very large and strong fortification, with another wall at the lower part of the slope behind. This was built in the 9th century, but this still was not the early wall. Before it you have the green one, which is quite difficult to detect because this large solid wall was mostly built on top of it. But even from the small trace which we have, it is quite clear, again, that it was a casemate wall. So we have here the interesting picture, which is also important for the dating of our various strata. The 10th century, probably Solomonic casemate wall. The 9th, 8th century, large solid wall. And again, the 7th century, still Iron Age, still of the period of the monarchy, a casemate wall. Into the citadel, you see here the traces of this red 9th century solid wall. It still stands even now to a height of 5 meters and more. Into it led this rock-hewn channel, which gives us some idea which effort was put to save really the water provision for the citadel in this period. It was a deep, about more than men high canal hewn into the rock, as you see here, leading through the wall. And this not from a spring, as I mentioned, or any aqueduct or like this, but only for the assembling of rainwater and leading it into the city. We are standing now on the wall, looking into the opening. It has been broken down a bit in antiquity, of one of these large and deep cisterns, which were under the buildings and also under the sanctuary in quite a large part of the citadel. This gives you perhaps some idea, well, only one chosen picture of one of our schoolboys helping us, usually, cleaning an Iron Age cooking pot from the 7th century BC, still being about intact and just near the ancient wall and sometimes even on the ancient oven as if it was left yesterday. I would say that was a quite common and usual picture of the broken pottery and the destruction levels in the rooms, which of course you see most of the pottery is broken, but if you find it like this, it's not difficult to save and put it together. And to giving you only a general glimpse of pottery of the 8th century of various vessels, like for instance these beautiful burnished bowls of the Iron Age. This one belonged to the 7th century BC. And now, going on to our inscriptional material, we found first of all almost complete series of the shekel weights. You have here the weight of 1, 2, 4, 8, and even 16 shekel with the signed inscription of the royal shekel and the various numbers inscribed of them. We have about half of our inscriptions, about 100, are Aramaic ostraca, which belonged not to these six citadels which I mentioned, but to a later Persian fortress at the place. They belong to about the same period as the Elephantine papyri, to about 400 BC. Some of them, like this one, have just lists of people or belongings. Here, for instance, you have the cave of Anani and his granary, and Erzari, probably listing of inventors. Some have, like this one, which starts Zinasa Kesef, this one which carried silver or money, and then it goes on, Kol Kesef, all the money, the sum of the money, and then probably the scribe made a mistake, and he turned the same letter, the same ostracon on the other side, and started once again, this one which carried silver or money, the sum of the money. Well, here it's not difficult to read, but then you have a list of people with quite interesting names and the sum of the money or silver due to them. And this, for instance, the last of these Aramaic ostraca, which makes the contents clear, where they come from, is somebody, Min Midinat, and here's an Aleph, from the province. The name of the province, only the first letter, has been preserved. And then somebody, you see it here very clearly, Ledegel Evet Nanai, like an elephantine belonging to the Degel, to the flag, if you want, or to the compagnon, to the regiment, called on Evet Nanai, an Aramaic name. And then somebody, Akavya Yehudi, Akavya, the Jew, Chemar Sri, wine Sri, Shemen for, and Kof Kemach for, oil for, and flour for. That means rationing for soldiers of different kind, among them Jews and Arameans, which were stayed in this period at the citadel of Arad, as I mentioned, after the destruction of the first temple. But we'll go back to the most interesting material of the first temple period. This one is not an ostracon, but a bowl where letters were inscribed. And as you see here, always the same three letters in ancient Hebrew characters appear. Ayin, Resh, Dalet. Arad, the name of our city, of our citadel, is strangely enough, as you see it here, you have it left to right, Ayin Resh Dalet. Here you have it right to left, Ayin Resh Dalet. But still the Resh and the Dalet pointing to the right in the wrong direction than they should point. I must agree that we have this sometimes in excavation that our students try to make some jokes with us. And when they first brought me this only one piece with these two kinds of Arad inscribed like this, I told my students, well, if you make a joke and write this, the name of the city like this, you should know better how to write it, and not in an obverse direction like this. Later, of course, we realized that it was no fake and that it is true. And I have still no real explanation what is the reason for this strange kind of obverse writing of the name of our place. In any case, it is an interesting and important evidence for the ancient name of the city at the place. But most, well, here you have perhaps our most ancient inscription. It is an ancient Hebrew seal. It has two names. Here you have Lid Drashyahu, Ben, belonging to Drashyahu, the son of, and of the last name, only the first letter, the Ayin, has been preserved. Well, I won't go into details, but it's quite clear that this seal can't be later than the 9th century, and even perhaps belongs to the 10th century BC. But most of our inscriptions, as I said, are ostraca, shirts like this, inscribed with ink. I'll show you first only a few of our earliest ostraca. This one, for instance, it belongs to our second citadel, somewhere near the end of the 9th century. It is one, I think, perhaps the earliest ostraca which we have at all in Palestine. And it has a list, two lists of names. Here, for instance, Menachem, Achimelech, and other names, which numerals after them. The most interesting thing is, of course, the question of paleography. Here, for instance, you have an ancient yod. And please look to this in another inscription. This one, as you see, it is not an ostraca, but again inscratched. You have here three ancient Hebrew letters. On this, chet, tzade, yod. Chetzi, which could mean half, but Professor Albright now suggested me a better explanation for this. Chetz in Hebrew is also an arrow, or may even be luck. So Chetzi is my arrow or my luck. And as we found this in the sanctuary, we'll of course come back to it, this explanation is more convincing than some Chetzi, some half, where we wouldn't know what a half of. But look, please, at this yod. If you have some idea of ancient Hebrew paleography, you know that the ancient yod is usually without this hook here at the end. And this cursive downstroke at the end of the letter has been known up till now only from Samaria, from the Samaria ostraca, and it was believed that it was a special kind of writing only in northern Israel, in the area of Samaria. Now it is clear that we have it also in Yehuda as well. We can date it quite clearly in Arad to our strata. It appears only in this stratum, and it is of course a quite important addition to the dating of the Samaria ostraca and of other ancient material. But I won't go on and bother you with ancient paleography, which is a quite technical and difficult specialized matter, and go on to our main archive of inscriptions, which was found in one of the rooms of the southern Kesmet wall, as you see it here. If anybody of you of Elmo still has any intentions to come back to some of our excavations, I must warn you beforehand that we invented, I would say, a very cruel invention for our staff. After the work, during the day on the mound, two of our volunteers, what they are doing here is what we call the so-called dipping of the shells. What means this? After the shells, of course, at the area are collected into baskets, which get their tickets and then taken to the camp, we realized that these ancient ostraca, inscribed shells, at the mound, at the area, it is almost impossible to detect them because they are covered with ashes and dust and dirt, and you can't see at the spot the ancient letters. But if you put them into water and start to scratch and wash them, well, it's very easily to wash them clean and to leave nothing of these ancient inscriptions on them. And I am quite afraid that quite a lot of ostraca and other excavations have been washed nicely and cleanly away in this manner. So we invented this, as I say, a very patientful and you need a lot of patience, of just the dipping of the pottery. That means every shell to take, just dip it into water and then look at it from both sides and don't think that on every second or third shell you find an ostraca. But usually you have to go over 1,000 or 2,000 or thousands of shells up till you find one or two letters, but I think it was worthwhile, and it is one of the reasons that we have this large amount of inscriptions at Arad. This is a picture of the main ostracon room as it was taken when I still did not realize that most of these shells are ostraca. I just took this photograph thinking that we have here broken vessels laying like this on the floor. But when these shells were taken and dipped below and fortunately not washed, this is what came out. I'll show you only a few of them and read them quickly, as of course on every one of them we could now sit about an hour and discuss it and ask about the language and the question which arises out of them, only give you a general impression what is in them and what they mean. It starts, well, I really don't know if many of you have any knowledge of ancient Hebrew. Should I read them in Hebrew or go immediately to English? What do you think? Immediately translate them.
Yes.
I thought perhaps no translation is necessary. I didn't know. Well, so let's immediately translate them. To El Yashiv, most of them are addressed to a person called El Yashiv, and we'll immediately return to this person. And now, give to the Kittiyim. Kittiyim, probably Greek mercenaries, if we take the biblical word in this period. Give to the Kittiyim wine. Here's a bait, probably batim, a measurement, 3. And write, or and note, the name of the day, Shem Hayom. We have a similar phrasing in Hezekiel. And from the rest of the first flower, take one, probably ephah of flour, la'asot lahem lechem, in order to make bread for them. From the wine of the aganot, give. Yes, give from the wine of the aganot a special large kind of vessel, so probably a special kind of wine. Well, showing you briefly some of the other ostracon, well, you can now read it already by yourself. It again starts to El Yashiv. And now give to the Kittiyim Batim 2 wine for the 4 days. Maybe 4 days of traveling which they had to do, as it is quite clear that these Kittim and other people brought these short letters with them to Arad, got their proviant, and they were kept in the archive as an evidence and as dockets for the keeping of the magazine. And three bread, and the full chomer, a larger measurement of wine, bring or deliver something like this tomorrow, al ta'acher, don't be late. Well, we won't go into further details. Let's hear briefly, at least the beginning of another one, to Eliashiv, and now, give from the wine three batim, and Hananyahu has ordered you, Tzivcha Hananyahu, al Be'er Sheva, to Be'er Sheva, to go to Be'er Sheva, with the load of two donkeys, and you should take, or you should load on them, probably matzot. What do you call a matzot in? Well, the special type of bread. It's interestingly enough that at least one of the commanders, a higher officer than our Eliashiv, Hananyahu, was at Be'er Sheva and ordered him to come there. This, for instance, I want to read all of it. It's only interesting that down here you have probably something about Ma'aser, the tithe, which he had to level our Eliashiv, Beterem Yavor HaChodesh, before the month is over. So our Eliashiv had also, not only was in charge of the magazine, he had also to do with collection of tithes and taxes. Here, for instance, you have one of these rather poor preserved ostraka, not of this archive, but another one. But you see clearly a row, again, rows of names or inscriptions with numerals after them. And here, for instance, again, clearly the word Ma'aser Taif, which were collected in Arad. Now, perhaps one of the most interesting, it was written by an inferior of Eliashiv, and therefore starts not only with the opening to my lord Eliashiv, but has also a greeting formula after it, which most of the other ostraka lack. Yahweh, the ancient name, which later was not pronounced, of course written here, the ancient tetragram like this, may ask to your welfare. And now, give to Shmaryahu something which is only indicated by a symbol. And to the Kerosi, Kuf Resh Samech Yud, give something else. And regarding the matter which you have ordered me, well, I'm sorry, in Hebrew these are only three words, in English much more, as the Hebrew language is shorter, but you have here in regarding the matter which you have ordered me, shalom. Well, it is all right. It has been done. Bet Yahweh Hu Yosef. In the house of the Lord, in the temple, he is dwelling. He is sitting. Well, this brings us now already near to our temple, to our sanctuary. At the first moment, of course, we thought, well, here we have our sanctuary at Arad. But this is clearly not. First, because the Arad sanctuary was already destroyed at this period. And then it is quite clear from the contents of this letter that this temple stood at the place from which the letter was sent. Our man here is telling Eliashiv in Arad that this and this was going on in the temple, in the Bet Yahweh. And I think it is therefore very probably that this temple here, the house of the Lord, is nothing else but the Solomonic temple in Jerusalem. We are here at the end of the first temple period, after Josiah's reform The Rat sanctuary was already destroyed. It's very improbable that another Beit Yahweh dispute existed outside Jerusalem in Judea. And this is strengthened by this name, Kerosi, which is one of the people bringing this letter. And the name Keros, the sons of Keros, appears in the Bible among the families of the Netinim, the temple servants in Jerusalem. So we have, I think, here quite clear connections of our Eliashiv to the Jerusalem temple and their servants and their people. We still know something more about Eliashiv. This is a letter addressed not to Eliashiv, but to one Nahum, El Nahum. And now, come or go to the house of Eliashiv, the son of Eshyahu. So this was his full name, Eliashiv, son of Eshyahu. And take from him one oil, one jar of oil. And bring or send it to me quickly, v'chatom oto b'chotamcha, and seal it with your seal. On the other side of this same astrakhan, we have a sword inscription in another handwriting. It's not the same handwriting. And here we have a date, in the 24th of the month, gave Nahum oil through the hand or in the hand of the kiti, one of these kitim, one jar. So we have here the indication that this was fulfilled. The date, it's very interesting that here the date numeral for 20 is the Egyptian hieratic numeral of 20, which I think brings now the final solution for the long debated question of the Samaria numerals and the usage of Egyptian hieratic numerals in the royal Judean and Israeli administration. And you see how this was noted down here and was sent by one of these kittiyim, one of these mercenaries, which always got as their proviant wine and bread, but oil had usually, and we have this also in other astraka, to deliver sealed. In a room near this astraka, but one stratum earlier, we found these three ancient Hebrew seals. All three of them have the same Hebrew inscription, Le Eliashiv ben Eshyahu. We may see this perhaps better on the next photograph. You see it here, Le Eliashiv ben Eshyahu, the same inscription on the other one. So these are the seals with which these jars and other letters and whatever was sent of the citadel were sealed. And you have the astonishing fact that these so-called private seals, if you would have found them, they have only a name on them belonging to Eliashiv, son of Eshyahu. No title at all. We would have believed that it was a private person, a landowner or something like this. But now we know his functions in Arad and know quite clearly that he used these seals, and more than one, probably used also by his inferiors, in his function as a royal functionary, a royal officer of Arad, which is, of course, I would say, very interesting, very illuminating for the interpretation of the ancient Hebrew seals and mainly even seal impressions, which have been found another place, but never, where we never know who really was the person who used them. I think here at Arad we have for the first time some knowledge about this person who used these ancient seals. As I mentioned, these seals were found one stratum earlier. This, of course, was very strange. At the beginning, we thought, well, perhaps we made a mistake in our stratification. But happily, together with these seals, we found also some ostraca. One is this probably Egyptian hieratic ostracon. It has not yet been deciphered. It is the first of its kind found at all. And as we have another few photographs, and one of them found together with these seals a Hebrew ostracon, which is a list of wheat distribution. It has the heading Chitim, Chet Pet Mem, wheat, and then a quite long list of names like Uriyahu, the son of Roga, Nechemyahu, Ben Yehoaz, Neriyahu, Ben Tzvariyahu, Achikam, Ben Shmayahu, and so on and so on, and the signs and numerals of the wheat which was distributed to him. This was very fortunate for us, not only that we have here probably part of the earlier archive, but it gave us also clear evidence that we are in the earlier stratum, because the script here in this ostracon, and again I don't want to point to details, it's impossible in this general lecture, is definitely and clearly earlier than the script of our Eliashiv ostracon. So we know that our Eliashiv, son of Eshiahu, was in charge of Arad and of all his functions in Arad, at least during two citadels, probably at least 30 to 40 years, from about the period of Josiah to the destruction, the final destruction of Arad in the period of Nebuchadnezzar. But we still can probably go back with the family of our Eliashiv, and this in the temple, which we'll discuss only in our next lecture. In one of the rooms of the temple, we found 7 or 8 small shelves, inscribed shelves, and on all of these shelves, only one name of a person, or what you have here, there are really two types. In this one, Pe, Shin, Chet, Resh, Pashchur, which is a well-known biblical name, and as you probably remember, a well-known priestly family. Now, we have here, among these shelves, this name of Pashchur, here for instance, Mem, Resh, Mem, Vav, Tav, Meremot, another priestly family. So we have priestly families, and we have other shelves with names of persons. It's of course a question what these shelves were used for. I think the most plausible thing is that they were used as a kind of lots, as we have it in the biblical description, for the priestly courses in the sanctuary. And I would say that this and this person probably served in the lot of this and this priestly family. And among the names of these persons, which are here then clearly connected with the sanctuary and with the duties of the sanctuary and probably priests, we have in this uppermost one, Eshiahu ben Ezer. Eshiahu, the son of Ezer, and as we are in our same citadel of Arad, well, we can't prove it, but I would say it is at least probably that this is nobody else but the father of our Eliashiv ben Eshiahu, which fulfilled here duties in the temple, in the sanctuary in Arad, was probably a priest. And again, we have the strengthening of the connections of our Eliashiv, which we have seen already in this previous ostracon, with the temple, with the Jerusalem temple, and with some, I would say, priestly administration connected with the royal citadel and with the sanctuary in the temple of Arad. But this temple, this sanctuary, which was, without any question, the most astonishing surprise which we had at Arad on Thursday. Thank you.